Let me return to some details of what Jim Garrison accomplished. As Garrison once quipped about the supposed lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, in fact, Oswald was virtually never alone. Now, moreover, he was not involved with anyone who was not connected to the CIA. Oswald was an FBI informant, Garrison learned from Louisiana Representative Hale Boggs, a member of the Warren Commission. And Garrison always said that the person who turned him on to the investigation of President Kennedy's death was Senator Russell Long. And people often criticize Garrison of talking to the press too much. And in fact, Garrison kept his secret until the day of his death. The person who involved him in the Kennedy investigation was not Senator Russell Long. In fact, I talked to Senator Russell Long's family, and Garrison always talked about a plane ride that he took with Russell Long in which they discussed the Kennedy assassination, and Russell Long convinced him to investigate. Well, what Russell Long's family told me was that when Russell Long got off the airplane, he said Garrison chewed his ear off about the Kennedy assassination. So the truth was the reverse. And one of those soldiers of fortune whom I just mentioned told me in Miami, the one true thing you said was that nothing is as it seems. It was Hale Boggs, obviously. Hale Boggs, a member of the Warren Commission, who had been at secret meetings, closed sessions of the Warren Commission, which talked about Lee Harvey Oswald's status as an FBI informant. And Alan Dulles told him, don't tell anyone about this. And Hale Boggs, of course, told Jim Garrison, and that was what really persuaded him to begin. I discovered a conversation Garrison did not know about. At the First District Police Station, where Oswald was taken after he was arrested for a disturbance when he was handing out his pro-Castro leaflets. And by the way, the documents reveal that the Fair Play for Cuba, which Oswald supposedly represented, was heavily infiltrated by CIA. Those documents are all available at the archives. Oswald requested of Lieutenant Francis Martello of the New Orleans Police that Martello call the FBI field office. Call the FBI, Oswald ordered Martello imperiously. Tell them you have Lee Oswald in custody. Oswald asked that Special Agent Warren DeBruys come down to see him. Obviously, Oswald was someone the New Orleans field office of the FBI knew well. The agent on duty that night, John Quigley, then asked a young clerk named William Walter, the person who took Martello's call, to check all the files, locked and unlocked, for what they had on Oswald. On one file jacket in the locked filing cabinet of the special agent in charge, where security files were kept, were two names, Lee Oswald and Warren DeBruys. To this day, Mr. DeBruys denies that he ever knew Oswald, and he's testified as such to many committees. So just before my book came out, I called him up on the pretext of how to spell his name correctly. Do you spell D-E with a capital D or with a small d? And I was waiting, would DeBruys say anything after all these years? And what he said to me was this: after 40 years, you wouldn't be a very intelligent person if you didn't change your mind about things. Now, that wouldn't hold up as a confession in court, but I take it as one. Oswald has also been part of the CIA counterintelligence false defector program. Oswald, I found new evidence to show, also worked for U.S. Customs in New Orleans, as many CIA people work for Customs. And some of those Customs officers, well, one of them, told the church committee, I've been waiting 10 years for someone to ask me what happened. And then he told about Oswald's role with Customs. Now, those boxes, only 25% of the church committee records are open to the public so far. So I had the summary of that, but not the actual deposition. Garrison began by exploring Oswald's government connections. He indicted Clay Shaw for participating in the conspiracy without having our government records released under the JFK Act. And by the way, I want to say again about the JFK Act, an extraordinary development we're not likely to witness anytime soon again. And these records show that Shaw was a CIA operative, and we have to thank Oliver Stone, because as a result of his film, people wrote to Congress and said, if this isn't true, if what Oliver Stone said in this film isn't true, open the records. And at that moment in 1992, they did. It wouldn't today. By shepherding Oswald around Louisiana, Shaw was repaying the CIA for considerable favors rendered. Because Shaw was acquitted, Garrison chose as the title of his third book, A Farewell to Justice. He never used that title, and so I appropriated it. And I think I had a right to do so. I did a book about Lillian Hellman once, and Lillian Hellman gave a course at Harvard to creative writing students, which she titled Stealing. And she said, never imitate. It's not okay to imitate other writers, but stealing is perfectly okay. You steal and you make it your own. And so I took Garrison's title. You can see that Garrison was a literary man. He liked Graham Greene in particular. He loved Shakespeare and obviously Hemingway. Part of my book includes how federal agencies worked actively to thwart Garrison's investigation. Garrison was astonished that the FBI refused to cooperate with New Orleans law enforcement in an investigation of the Kennedy assassination. In fact, J. Edgar Hoover, we know who that is, subverted Garrison's effort. Witnesses came forward to the FBI believing that in providing the FBI with their information, they were simultaneously reaching the district attorney. And the document reads as follows, "Give Garrison nothing." Hoover wrote to all special agents in charge, adding, in reference to the special agent in charge in New Orleans, Robert Reitmeier, quote, "Tell Reitmeier that I want him and all personnel in New Orleans to keep their mouths shut." This was February 1967, a week after Jim Garrison's investigation became public. Bobby Kennedy's right-hand man, Walter Sheridan, had spearheaded the blackmail, bribery, and wiretapping that accomplished the conviction of Jimmy Hoffa. The evidence of Walter Sheridan's illegalities in the railroading of Jimmy Hoffa is chronicled in Fred Cook's brilliant three-part series in The Nation magazine. A further irony is that Chief Justice Earl Warren, enlisted by Lyndon Johnson to rubber stamp the preordained conclusion that Oswald murdered President Kennedy, wrote what seems to me a brilliant dissent when the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed the Hoffa conviction. I asked a friend of mine, I'm not saying this, I asked Richard A. Posner, well, do you agree with me about Earl Warren's dissent there? And I have to tell you, he did not. He did not. Bobby Kennedy then sent Sheridan to New Orleans, as Sheridan freely admitted, to destroy Jim Garrison. That same National Security Agency spying on American citizens today spawned Walter Sheridan, who was also cleared for service with FBI and CIA. Sheridan personally telephoned the governors of several states to ensure that Garrison subpoenaed witnesses not be extradited back to the state of Louisiana. Not a single witness was returned to New Orleans. In the recent attacks on Jim Garrison may be found the preposterous notion that the only reason Garrison focused on the CIA was that he was the victim of KGB propaganda flowing from an Italian newspaper, Paese Sera. This total falsehood, and I mentioned this earlier, has been defended by Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. One of the half dozen anti-Garrison articles appeared, not surprisingly, on the CIA's own website, Studies in Intelligence. As a biographer, among the questions I asked was, did Jim Garrison take bribes from executives profiting from pinball machine gambling, then illegal in Orleans Parish? You could play pinball, but you couldn't gamble with a pinball machine, for which he was charged by the federal government. Was Jim Garrison dishonest? The new documents reveal that after Shaw's acquittal, after he perjured himself and suborned perjury, Garrison was ready to continue his investigation, only for that same operative, Walter Sheridan, to return to New Orleans and blackmail Garrison's friend and former chief investigator, Pershing Gervais. This is from the documents, not from interviews. I did 1,000, by the way. Would Gervais not help them to nail Garrison for taking bribes from pinball gambling interests? Gervais would go to jail for 8 years. The document is that specific, for income tax fraud. So we see in this story the mutual cooperation of agencies, the FBI helping the CIA, the IRS enlisted by the National Security Agency, and the CIA. Years later, on the occasion of Oliver Stone's film JFK, Anthony Lewis wrote in the New York Times that Garrison had taken bribes. In fact, Garrison was acquitted. The bribes were indeed going to a, quote, big man at Tulane and Broad, but it was not 6'6" Jim Garrison, but Chief of Police Joseph Giaruso. The police headquarters was also at Tulane and Broad. Addressing a frequent attempt to discredit Jim Garrison, I also had to ask, was Garrison tied to the mafia? Did he blame the CIA for the assassination as a way of protecting the mafia? I learned that Carlos Marcello, the mafia chieftain of Louisiana and Texas, despised Garrison and wanted him out of office. Garrison was, quote, unreliable. Marcello complained to Governor John J. McKiffin, whose assistant John Tarver relayed this to me. McKiffin himself did take bribes, and a person who ran against him in 1968, named John Rarick, told me the story where John Rarick's campaign manager was visited by Carlos Marcello's person and offered $50,000. And John Rarick's man refused, and Carlos Marcello's representative said, well, a big John took his. So in other words, Marcello was giving $50,000 to each side. The final chapter of my book entitled Rabbi reflects my interviews with a person who was involved in setting up the assassination, a man named Thomas Edward Beckham. It describes his CIA training at a facility in Virginia. Beckham presented me with a government document which describes him as a man who would feel no guilt about killing. This phrase matches in language documents released by the Church Committee describing the assassins hired by the CIA in their assassination attempts against foreign leaders, Lumumba, Trujillo, Diem, and of course Fidel Castro. Beckham had been subjected to a polygraph by the New Orleans police in the late 1970s. When Robert Blakey and Gary Cornwell, who headed the House Select Committee on Assassinations, discovered this, the Louisiana investigators were suspended for conducting a polygraph without authorization. The CIA controlled that investigation, as it did the Warren Commission. My favorite anecdote concerns the moment when former Justice Arthur Goldberg was asked to head the committee after Philadelphia prosecutor Richard A. Sprague was fired. Knowing that the CIA held the truth about the assassination, Goldberg telephoned the director of Central Intelligence, Stansfield Turner, and asked whether, should he take the job, he would be given full CIA cooperation. He asked his question again. There was silence. He asked his question again. Only then did Turner reply, "I thought my silence was my answer." Goldberg did not take the job. My final question came at my last interview in Miami in June of 2005. It was one that also perplexed Jim Garrison. Why did Bobby Kennedy try to sabotage his investigation through Walter Sheridan? I interviewed a Cuban close to Robert Kennedy who revealed that Robert Kennedy had Oswald under surveillance in New Orleans during the summer of 1963. Like Professor Schlesinger, Robert Kennedy looked first to the CIA for responsibility in the murder of his brother. On the day of the assassination, Bobby confronted John McCone, the director of Central Intelligence, with this question: did the CIA kill my brother? He told Harry Ruiz Williams, one of the Cubans working for him, confirming his prior awareness of Oswald, "One of your guys did it." And it was not a question, but a statement. Wanting to be certain, Bobby sent that same Walter Sheridan to Dallas to find out if the Mafia had planned the crime. They had not. Bobby also asked a Mafia-connected Chicago lawyer, Julius Drasnin, who worked for the NLRB, the same question. The answer, as Drasnin reported to Walter Sheridan, was that the assassination was not a Mafia hit. Years later, Sheridan would testify under oath that the Mafia was behind the assassination. He knew better. It was in the circles of the anti-Castro movement that Bobby Kennedy moved, his aim to protect the life of his brother from some Cuban still furious about the Bay of Pigs. His other aim was to, quote, neutralize Fidel Castro. Since the Church Committee hearings, newspapers have reported on Operation Mongoose, the CIA Mafia plots to assassinate Fidel Castro. Bobby Kennedy's separate efforts have been less widely publicized, but I have it confirmed from many people, including Ramsey Clark. It was in this Miami research that I discovered my parallel between the cover-up by the 9/11 Commission of the Able Danger information and a similar set of facts that faced the Warren Commission in its closing days. It reveals information that bears upon why Robert F. Kennedy was so nervous about Jim Garrison's investigation and about any investigation of his brother's death. This began at the Bethesda autopsy, nothing to do with Jim Garrison. One of the doctors, Pierre Fink, testified for the defense in New Orleans at State of Louisiana versus Clay Shaw that the Kennedy family had asked that the trajectory of the president's wounds not be examined. "If my brother were killed," Garrison said, "I would be interested in getting the individuals involved, no matter who they were." Garrison made this statement on national television, exasperated by the persistent question by news people, "If you're on the right track, why isn't Bobby Kennedy helping you?" Late in its deliberations, the Warren Commission discovered that Lee Harvey Oswald had visited a Cuban exile and former law student named Sylvia Odio in Dallas in late September 1963. During the weekend of the assassination, Mrs. Odio and her sister Annie both at once identified Oswald as the man who had visited them in the presence of two Cubans, whom Sylvia Odio would never identify. Mrs. Odio testified before the Warren Commission. She said that the day after that visit, one of the Cubans had telephoned her and in the course of the conversation remarked that Leon Oswald had said President Kennedy should have been assassinated after the Bay of Pigs and some Cuban should have done that. It's so easy to do it. Indicating both foreknowledge of the assassination and that Oswald was being set up. The Warren Commission never adequately investigated this information. They certainly didn't call Leopoldo, the man who phoned Sylvia Odio, just as the 9/11 Commission didn't feel obliged to investigate the Able Danger documents. The Warren Commission's chief counsel, J. Lee Rankin, expressed irritation at the very suggestion that Sylvia Odio's story should be fully investigated, murmuring, "We were supposed to be closing doors, not opening them." Years later, Rankin was bitter that the FBI and CIA had concealed vital information from the Warren Commission. Deposed in the late 1970s by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Rankin admitted that he regretted that he had taken the CIA's word that Oswald was never a CIA agent. Invited to ask if he had anything further to say, this was after the questioning, Rankin had a question for the lawyers and committee members in the room. Was the HSCA investigating whether the people involved in the CIA cover-up were involved in the assassination as well? He received the same response Arthur Goldberg had. Silence. The Warren Commission lacked a context in which to evaluate the incident of Oswald visiting Sylvia Odio because the FBI and CIA both, on the instruction of Chief of Counterintelligence James Angleton, concealed the CIA's history of attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro, now a matter of public record. In my pursuit of the question of why Bobby Kennedy tried to sabotage Jim Garrison's investigation, Garrison used the word torpedo, I studied the minutes of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, I recommend that to all researchers, and the Church Committee papers. I tried to interview Cubans who worked closely with the Attorney General, and this is some of what I discovered, and then I'll close. Bobby Kennedy had assembled a team of anti-Castro Cubans. One, Manolo Rebozo, is now living in Nicaragua, having married into the wealthy Somoza family. Another, Manuel Artime, is dead. But I did find a man named Angelo Morgado, a man so devoted to the Kennedys that at his citizenship hearing, he changed his name from Morgado to Kennedy in homage to a person whom he admired. That is Bobby. If you look in the, you won't find him in the Miami telephone book. Angelo told me that Bobby's instructions to his special team were twofold. One aim was to find a means of getting rid of Fidel Castro. Bobby's other aim was to protect his brother. He sent these Cubans to New Orleans, moving among, as Angelo puts it, Castro's agents, double agents, and Cubans working for the CIA. They hoped to, quote, neutralize a future assassin. In New Orleans, Angelo Morgado ran into Lee Harvey Oswald, who was moving among the anti-Castro community. He put Oswald under surveillance. When I mentioned that I had discovered Oswald's acquaintance with an anti-Castro Cuban named Juan Valdez, and of course he laughed, that couldn't possibly be anybody's real name, who worked at Clay Shaw's International Trademark, Angelo was dubious. How could that be? He knew everyone Oswald was acquainted with, and he didn't know of this man. That's how close to Oswald they drew. Scrutinizing Oswald and reporting back to Bobby, his team discovered that Oswald was an informant for the FBI. Learning this, Bobby reasoned, if the FBI is controlling him, he's no problem. Bobby underestimated the role Oswald had been induced to play in the murder of his brother and ceased to make him a major target of his concern. Bobby knew, quote, something was cooking in New Orleans, Angelo Morgado told me, but Bobby urged caution. He was out of his depth. In September, it was Angelo and a fellow veteran of the Bay of Pigs who traveled from New Orleans to Dallas to visit Sylvia Odio. Angelo believed they were there to marshal help for the anti-Castro efforts and talked about buying arms to support anti-Castro efforts within Cuba. Mrs. Odio's father, in jail in Cuba, headed a liberal organization called JURE, J-U-R-E. Its position, Fidelismo sin Fidel. Angelo believed that he could trust his companion, referred to in the Warren Report as Leopoldo, because not only was he a fellow veteran of the Bay of Pigs, but his brother was running for mayor of Miami. He was respectable. The next day, out of Angelo's hearing, and that's very important, out of Angelo's hearing, Leopoldo phoned Mrs. Odio to tell her how Leon Oswald had talked about the need to murder President Kennedy. Leon is kind of nuts, Leopoldo stated, setting up Oswald as the patsy. Oswald's mental imbalance forms the conclusion of the Warren Report. Oswald was called Leon a number of times, not least at a gathering at David Ferry's apartment where Clay Shaw and Ferry, Garrison's chief suspects, discussed what their alibis would be for November 22nd. At Sylvia Odio's, Angelo used his true given name, Angelo Morgado. Leopoldo was an alias. Placing Oswald in the company of so close an associate of Bobby Kennedy in an incident that points to foreknowledge of the assassination as well as the framing of Oswald created the trap that would silence Bobby forever. Bobby asked his aide, Frank Mankiewicz, whether, quote, any of our people were involved, and Mankiewicz told me he had asked himself, did you think there might be? Angelo, meanwhile, had been betrayed by a companion he believed he could trust, a man not so much assigned to the overthrow of Fidel Castro, as Angelo believed, as he was to arrange for Oswald to be blamed for the murder of the president. Leopoldo was a Cuban named Bernardo de Torres. A virtual flood of documents reveals that he was an asset of both the CIA and military intelligence. When he was subpoenaed before the House Select Committee, CIA arrived on the day de Torres was deposed to insist that he be granted immunity. The CIA so totally controlled that committee that they agreed to the CIA demand that de Torres would not be questioned about the period of time leading up to the Kennedy assassination. Both the Warren Commission and the HSCA buried what they knew about Oswald's participation in anti-Castro activities, information that would have led directly to the role of the CIA in the assassination. I believe that we are now suffering the consequences of allowing lies about what happened to President Kennedy to remain unchallenged. The consequence of the public not demanding that the murder of the head of state be properly investigated has led directly to the current undermining of the integrity of our democratic institutions, not least the press. An obvious consequence of the obfuscations of the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee has been the ease with which the 9/11 Commission was able to conceal important truths. I wrote my book to make a small contribution to the need for government accountability and openness, because what is at stake, if I can be grandiose for a second, is democracy itself. And now I'll close with one line. It's a line from Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., from a sermon of 1967, the year before his death. No lie can live forever. Thank you.
That was Professor Joan Mellon, author of A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History, speaking at the Society for Ethical Culture in New York City in January.